Welcome to Heart with Keisha B., the podcast that focuses on the journey of grief, healing, and overcoming unforeseen circumstances. Whether you're dealing with loss or life challenges, this is a podcast that you don't want to miss. I am your host, Keisha B. So take a deep breath, open your mind and your soul, and sit back as we embark on this journey together. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Heart today. Today, we have a special guest with us who's going to be able to pour her heart out with you all to talk about things in which she has encountered as she has walked this life of grief, healing, and just adjusting to unforeseen circumstances. Today, we're going to talk about beyond the smiles, the unspoken challenges of adoptive parenting. Hello, Liz. How are you today?
I'm great, Keisha. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So, Liz, again, before I even get started, this is a topic I know for certain that many people will be able to be inspired by, right? Whether they have been a foster parent, adoptive parent, and or have just been an individual who've grown up in an adoptive system. So, Liz, do you want to share a little bit about yourself and your story with our guest today?
Sure. Yeah. So I am a mother of four. We started our family through adoption. We adopted twins. Our oldest two are twins, boy and girl, and that we adopted as toddlers internationally. And then when they were about 6 years old, we had our first biological child. And then a couple years later, we had another one. So we have sort of a blended family between adoptive children and birth children.
So Liz, this may be a question that may be an understood question just based upon the time frame that you have given. But do you want to talk about when you and your husband began to analyze what does life look like for us, why you all made a decision to become adoptive parents?
Yeah, so we always wanted to adopt. So it was sort of one of those things where, you know, we were dating, we were getting very serious, and you start sort of planning your future a little bit. And so on my side of the family, I have cousins that are adopted, and then generations back, I think I have a second cousin who has 15 children that she adopted. And then my husband has adoptive children in his family as well. So it just seemed like, well, this is what we're going to do. So that was really how the whole thing started. We just wanted to be parents, and we knew we were going to at some point adopt, whether it was going to be before biological or after biological or whatever. So that's how we started with twins.
Okay. So let's start out very deeply. What has this journey been like for you? What has this journey been like for your family?
Yikes. So that is a very tricky question, Keisha. So the journey initially was, you know, pretty intense of just getting the paperwork. So we went international, which I don't have experience with going through and applying through the foster care system in the U.S. So I can't speak too much on that process of the paperwork and everything. But internationally, we had to do a ton of paperwork. So we had to do a dossier that was probably 6 or 7 inches tall of who we were, what we were all about, who we worked for. Did we own our house? Did we rent our house? Were we criminals? So we had to go through psychological tests, HIV tests, letters of references. So we had to do all these different things just to get on the list. So that sort of starts out with a, well, you know, bio parents don't need to go through all this, and any old fool can have a baby. You know,
right.
It started out like that. But so it was almost 2 years before we were matched with our children, and then we were able to meet them. So it was almost 2 years for that. We had about 4 weeks notice from the time they called and said, hey, you're going to be a mother. Here, come get these two toddlers that have never heard English and have no idea who you are. And you're going to pull them out of an orphanage. So that was a little, you know, a little tricky. And at one point it was like, am I ready for this? Which I think is not uncommon for any parent, right? A newborn, you're like, oh no, what has happened here? But yeah, so that was initially the start of it. And so we were one month in their country and then came home and really just sort of just went day by day. And I think it's very similar to any new parent where you're like, how did I get here? I don't know what I'm doing. Everybody else has it figured out. What do I do? So we relied really on our parents, on friends who had other kids, you know, just trying to build your network of, is this normal? Is this not normal? What do I do? Holy smokes. It's an awesome right. responsibility, right? To have children. So that's really how it started. Which again is not, that part is not unusual, I don't think, to our family, but, you know, we started seeing some behaviors when they were a little bit older and it was like, oh, well, you know, they've never heard English. They've never had somebody teach them not to do this. They've never had these opportunities. And so I kind of went back and forth with, oh, they've never had it. Maybe I'll let them get away with it because they've already mm-hmm. experienced so much trauma and so much disruption in their little lives to know this is how we're going to do it from here on out. And this is how I was parented. It's got to work for this kid. So that was probably the biggest smack in the face was that, mm-hmm. you know, you parent all kids a little bit differently, but it's much different when you don't know the exposure that your kids had before you even met them. Yeah. So, and that changes the brain a little bit. So I've learned a lot over mm-hmm. the years.
And I think, you know, what you just said is, you know, not knowing where your children have come from, right? Genetically, not even knowing where they've come from. Right. And so, as we know, there is no book, right? There's no book to any type of parenting whatsoever, whether they're biological children, foster children, adoptive children. It's almost like day to day, you're learning not just how to be a parent, but you're also learning this unique child.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So here's my question for you, because I can recall a day where my cousin had twins, right? And I thought, you know, I'm going to just babysit these kids because she needs help. Little did I know what a challenge that was going to be. And I had already had three children of my own. So my question to you, Liz, is when you and your husband had decided to become foster parents internationally, did you ask for two children? Or did you just say, we'll take whoever we want to be blessed with?
Yeah. So initially we asked for one because it never even occurred to me that you could ask for more than one unless you were going for a sibling group or, you know, something mm-hmm. else. So we asked for one, and the way it worked at the time was the children that you were matched with depended on your current age. And so if you okay. were younger, then they thought you were more apt to have a younger child. If you were older, then you might be better with an older child. And so at the time we fit the criteria for young children. Okay. So we were on our paperwork, it said younger than three and as healthy as possible, because then there was also sort of a check, which is terrible, but there's also sort of a checklist of like, mm-hmm. will you accept special needs? And then within special needs, what criteria? Because, you know, mm-hmm. that meaning varies differently. Right. And so we originally had asked for healthy, younger than three, just one. And then at the last minute, my brother had twins. And so at the last minute, I was like, put us down for one or twins. Uh-huh. And the agency was like, yeah, no, that doesn't happen. There's never twins because twins are a lot to begin with. And mm-hmm. it's very rare to have two healthy twins available for adoption.
Right.
At least at the time in the country and the agency that we were working with. So they all thought I was crazy. And I was like, well, there's no harm. And just, you know, just put it down. It's easier to say two and get one than. So they all thought I was crazy. And then when they called us, they said the same thing. We've never heard of anybody getting twins. This is amazing.
Do you mind sharing which country your children are natives of?
Oh, sure. They're from Peru.
So definitely when you speak of the language barrier, so I now understand what you mean in regards to the language barrier outside of just all the other dynamics that the twins may have encountered.
Right.
Yeah. So I hear you say thereafter you had your own biological child. Mm-hmm. What did life look like for you at that point where you had been raising twins and then biologically you all were able to conceive as well?
Yeah. So I was terrified. Number one, to have a newborn, because, you know, I started off with kids that were walking and sort of talking and, you know, just running in opposite directions to mm-hmm. having like this little floppy little baby. My initial concern was that there was no way I was going to love this child as much as I love my twins. Wow. So I remember talking to other parents and they're like, no, that's not really a concern. Like, you will love your children. It mm-hmm. doesn't matter. But I was really terrified. Like, I could not even imagine loving another child as much as I love them.
Okay.
And out, they were all right. I had nothing to be concerned about. But
what has the interaction been? I heard you say that the twins have hit some behavior issues mm-hmm. and then your daughter. And I asked this question because whether they're adopted, whether they're foster kids or whether they're biological children, biological parents have the same, you know, can face the same challenges of having their own biological children who have some behavior issues and a child that does not. So what has that been like in your home?
So initially when the first one was born and he was probably, I don't know, 6 months or so, when they start to really smile and they're cooing and they're, you know, they're happy, I noticed that my son was really jealous. And he was really jealous that the baby was happy all the time. And he would say, like, so happy. Why is he so happy? And then we would find him pinching the baby. You know, the baby would be happy. The next thing you know, the baby's crying for no, you know, what we thought was no reason. But it turns out that he was being pinched. And so there was a lot of jealousy, but beyond probably what I would assume is like a traditional jealous sibling rivalry jealousy sort of thing. But I didn't really realize that because again, I didn't have kids before. I had, you know, I started off with twins and they fought, but they were the same age. And so it took me a while to really see that my oldest son was really struggling with seeing a happy baby. And maybe he's happy because he's has never experienced all these other things that, of course, my son, my oldest son, didn't even remember, right? Because he was young. He has no recollection of his pre-verbal life. But, you know, here he is 6 or 7 years old and he's pinching the baby and he's like taking the baby's toys and taking the pacifier out of his mouth and doing all these things that maybe aren't typical. But again, I don't know that. So I relied on asking people like, is this, you know, does this happen? So it started with that sort of thing, like just a hyper jealousy of what it seemed to be.
So Liz, let's dive into Liz. Let's dive into Liz being a mother, and we all know what that comes with, right? Just trying to balance life, right? Just trying to balance being a mother, being a wife, and just being there for Liz. So let's walk us through, what did life look like for Liz emotionally? What did life look like for Liz from the support or the lack thereof?
Yeah. So initially, I think I probably did what most other mothers do is just, you know, I try to carve out some time for myself and, you know, take a class here and there or just get out with some friends. I was lucky enough, we had a fantastic babysitter for my kids. So she really was like having my own wife, which sounds very sexist, but really it was a backup, right? It was a support. Right. And she would help me under every circumstance, you know, bathe the kids, help feed the kid. Like she would do all these things. So I didn't feel that immediate pressure of everything. Mm-hmm. At the same time, she was so awesome that when I came home from work, the kids were great. You know, the kids had a great day. We went to the park, we did this. So I didn't hear all the behavior things. Right. And it wasn't until we had some distance from her that I started seeing things and I'm like, were they doing this all along? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know, or was she hiding it, or was it just not showing up? You know? So then it became a cycle of blame. Like, is it me? Maybe I'm not the right parent for these kids. Maybe I'm overreacting. Maybe I'm seeing things differently. Maybe, you know, all these different things. And then the advice I would get from friends and family, you know, was always, you know, maybe you should just, you know, spank your kid and do this and do that and tell them that. And do they realize how lucky they are? You know, just what people think is helpful, but not really helpful. And then it sort of turned into, well, you must be exaggerating because these children are angels. They're so sweet when they're around anybody else. So how could they be doing that in your home? It must be you.
Right.
So then it does make you sort of question as a mother, like, is it me? Maybe it is me. And it goes back to, am I the right parent for these kids? What do I do? What am I doing wrong? Why don't they understand that I can help them when they're sad and I can kiss their boo-boos when they're hurt and all these things. Right.
As you know, with Heart to Heart, we focus on grief and healing. Yeah. And grief can come in so many different ways, right? It's just not about physically losing someone to death. It's about your emotions being turned upside down for so many different reasons, right? And so what I hear Liz saying is that Liz began to feel as if she wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
Liz, I want to assume, begin to have some self-blame.
Yes.
Walk us through, how were you able to work through the self-blame? Because it seems like even when you were trying to talk to people, they wasn't really listening. So how did Liz navigate this space when Liz probably felt many times that she was alone?
Yeah. So I still feel that way. Let's preface it by, it hasn't completely gone away.
Okay.
I think I've been able to manage my own feelings about it much better. Over time, I've become more educated about how my kids think and how they process things. And I have been told, I don't want to say it's all bad, because I have been told by a few folks, and it's nothing that I've done, you know, right? Like they're acting out. It's nothing that I've done. But at the same time, you go like, well, but I've taught my children right from wrong. You know, I've given them the structure. I've given them all these parameters of how to be a responsible, productive individual, you know, to be caring for other people, to do all these things, but yet it doesn't translate well. You know, something's going on. So to answer your question, the self-blame is still there, because there's always that what if I would have done this? What if I would have done that? And even just going back from, what if these were my biological children and we had the same outcome? Would I feel differently? I don't think I would, but you know, I mean, I've had professionals say to me like, well, if they were your biological children, you wouldn't be so mad. But yeah, I would. I'd be mad if anybody treated me this way or treated themselves that way. And so I've had to really move past the it's my fault and move towards I've done everything I possibly can. Mm-hmm. And the future that I saw, the family that I had envisioned, is not exactly what I have, and that's okay. It's really taken a lot of work to say, like, I've done everything I could possibly have done, and be forgiving of myself and show myself some grace that, yeah, it's just, it's an ongoing struggle, but I do the best I can today. I think I did it then. Should I have done things maybe a little bit differently? If I could have, but you know, I can't go back in time. Right. So it's more about self-forgiveness really than trying to correct it all and take the blame, because society will try to blame you over and over and there's nothing I can do about it.
So you said two key words that I often use just in my own personal daily life, right? Grace and forgiveness.
Yeah.
Right. They may seem like very small words, but they're very powerful words. Mm-hmm. Just giving yourself grace to know that I've done the best I can with a situation that was so unknown, right? And I use that statement because, again, children don't come with books. You can read all the parenting books that you want that's out there on the shelves, and it's still not going to prepare you to be a parent. It just gives you insight. It gives you a little bit of opportunity to have some support of understanding. Maybe I need to navigate this way in this space, right? But something else that you said I thought that was very imperative is that you had this vision of what it was going to look like. You know, I think back to the days when I was pregnant and I found out I was having a daughter. I had all these visions of what it was going to look like to raise a daughter. Little did I know it was nothing like that, right? Little did I know that all these expectations that I thought I was going to be able to place upon this child, she wasn't going to do.
Yeah.
Right? She was going to do, or has done, what she wanted to do. And it, and like you said, sometimes we as parents, we sit back and we blame ourselves, but here's the key thing. They're humans.
Right.
Right. They're humans with a mind of their own to do sometimes whatever they want to do, whether we want them to do that or not. But I think a key factor in this, Liz, is that some of what they do is based upon the great things that you have instilled in them.
Right.
I think sometimes as parents, when we may have to take a step back and realize that sometimes we do the best that we can do based upon the resources we have emotionally, physically, financially, or whatever. You know?
Yes. Yeah. I at one point we were in a therapy session and I was like, I don't understand why they're doing this and this and this. And the therapist just said, well, but why haven't they, like, you know, there was a threat or something. Well, why haven't they done it? You know, why haven't they come through on this threat? And I was like, well, I don't know. And they said, well, something's stopping them. So something, like you said, something is sinking in. Something is preventing them from taking further extreme action. So yay, right? Like something's happening. So it's the little wins that really you have to hold on to really keep yourself sort of motivated and really just comfortable knowing that you did as best as you could possibly do. And some things just happen. And you can't control it all, but what you can control is, you know, like everybody else, you know, just how you respond to it and how you react and how you carry it with you.
So Liz, the mom, has told me Liz's version of what she had expected or what she had envisioned as a parent. Tell me about Liz, the wife, that's an adoptive parent.
Yeah. So I did not expect, some of the behaviors that my kids have had or do have still, is triangulation. So, you know, I think all kids do the mommy daddy game where, you know, well, she said I could do it, but now you won't. So I'll go, you know, I'll ask the parent that's more likely to say yes. But in my situation, it was not who's going to give me yes. It is, I'm going to make something completely up and tell the other person, or I'm going to have some behaviors where the other parent doesn't see it. So then this parent looks like they're making it up and sort of pitting themselves against one another. So for example, my child would get really, really upset about something and not show it at the time, but sort of let it fester and everything. And then hurt himself and say that my husband had hurt him. You know, 5 minutes ago, he did this to me. But meanwhile, 5 minutes ago, my husband was with me in the same room. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's an example because he was right there. So I know it's untrue. And there's, you know, it was one of those things where he would do the same to me. You know, he would do something to me when my husband was at work or something. And then I would say, like, I can't take it anymore. Like, I don't know. I can't turn my back because then one of the other kids is having an accident or something is happening. And it was like, no, you're overreacting. And then you start to feel like, well, you don't believe me. And again, maybe it is me. Maybe I am imagining things. And then feeling resentful that my partner doesn't believe me. And I would have no reason to make this up. And why don't you believe me? And we're supposed to be in this together, but something is happening. And then conversely, you know, if something did bother me and I would tell him, he didn't always just listen. You know, he's a fixer. So his initial reaction was to go and confront my child and have a conversation about how you don't do this, you don't do that. And then that one, then the kid gets upset and then the husband gets. And so then the whole household turns into chaos. So to avoid that, I just wouldn't tell him. Mm-hmm. But then, and then I'm resentful that I'm partnered with someone who I can't talk to. And then that turns back into anger towards my kid because you did this and you knew you did it. And now I can't tell him because he's going to get mad at you. And then the other ones are going to get in a frenzy. So it turns into just this big cycle of resentment and anger. And how do I possibly explain this and say, I don't need you to fix it. I need you to listen. I mean, I need you to help me work through finding a solution, but I don't need you to take action.
Right.
Towards, you know, the situation. So yeah, it's a lot of, why don't you believe me? And why don't you see this? And why are you letting this go unchecked when it probably, you know, this is a deeper issue.
So it's a matter of just wanting to be heard, right? Heard and supported.
Heard and supportive, 1,000%. Yes.
So have you been able to speak to other foster parents to say, is this something that other folks deal with, or is it just in my home that I'm dealing with it?
Yeah. It took me a while to find those people because this is, you know, this isn't your everyday conversation. You know, most people are like, oh, you know, my husband's great. My husband's annoying. Like my kids are driving me crazy. You know, it's very surface level things. Mm-hmm. So it took me, I want to say my kids were probably 11 or 12 before I met another parent that had similar situations.
Okay.
That didn't just say like, oh, all kids are like that. You know, oh, these teen years, you know, preteen years or puberty or something, you know, everybody's talking back and everybody's doing this. Like, no. This is something different. And this is more than just being a parent. This is the whole ecosystem of my home because now I'm isolated because I have nobody to talk to. Nobody believes me. And so what I found was once I heard other people sort of experiencing the same thing, it goes back to that, so it's not just me.
All right.
And maybe there is something here. And so I really do, when I meet adoptive parents, foster parents, I am always like, yeah, okay, are you listening for this? You guys are on the same page? Because it's so important to, even if you're not on the same page, just present to your children like you are, right? Like, and then you can have your own discussion afterwards, because as soon as they see that little kink in your armor that maybe you're not as one, then... Mm-hmm. They can pounce. They can sniff it. They sniff it out.
Right.
And we'll try to manipulate and triangulate the two.
And I think, you know, as you are a adoptive parent, some of my experiences in speaking with parents who are foster parents, when we look at the grief, when we look at the healing, even with the manipulation, right, that still lies there. When you look at children coming in and out of homes because they have been in the system for so long. So they're learning new behaviors of how to manipulate a situation for whatever the reason may be. And so what I hear you saying is that your children are adoptive children, but you still had the manipulation in the home.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which may not just solely be because they're adopted. It may just be because they're kids.
Right.
All right.
And that's how, and it's hard to figure out what's what. Like one right. is one is a deeper problem. Mm-hmm. One is a phase.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So if you were to talk to a parent who's just considering being an adoptive parent, and again, I know there's a fine line between being an adoptive parent and a foster parent. But if you were to talk to a parent who's just a person who's just considering to start beginning to educate themselves on should they take the next steps, what would be some of your advice for that person or for that couple?
Yeah. So first of all, I think, you know, if you're parenting a child, whether they're in your home temporarily or permanently, I think, you know, you go into the idea of being an adoptive or a foster parent of saying like, I accept this child. I'm going to pour love into them and teach them that they're worthy, right? Mm-hmm. That regardless of they're there for a week, 2 months, or forever, you have the anticipation, you have the expectation that you're pouring love into them and they are going to be like, no one's ever loved me this much. Thank you. You know, now I feel worthy. Now I feel like I can conquer the world and this is great. But that's not really, that doesn't always happen. So mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest fallacy that I think parents, foster and adoptive parents come across of, I can give them a safe place. I can show them what love is. And that is going to fix things. That's going to help them see that they can conquer the world, that they can do great things. But what they don't realize is that that child doesn't feel that. And so their initial reaction is to reject that because they've learned from whatever reason, from in utero trauma to being separated from their original parents to whatever, however they ended up with you, they've learned that maybe they can't trust the world. And you can tell them over and over and over, I'm your person. I'm here. I'm going to hug you when you're sad. I'm going to be here for everything. But the world hasn't shown them that. And that's an ongoing struggle, is to really be prepared. First of all, be prepared for the rejection because mm-hmm. you think, I love you. I will give you anything you want, material, you know, any items you need, any emotional support you need, anything, but they want it, but they're scared to death of it. So they're going to push away. And I think that is the hardest part that nobody can ever explain in enough detail to know that the rejection, again, is not a reflection of you.
All right.
But it's tough. It is very, very tough. I mean, the behaviors certainly are unexpected, but you can work through that, you know, with the right supports and the right things, but the rejection is the hardest thing. So I think if you're going into it, you just have to be prepared that you think you can pour love and care and they're going to willingly accept it. Mm-hmm. No, not so much.
So how did you handle the rejection, Liz, from the children?
Oh, I'm still trying to handle it. You know, it's silly thing, not silly things, but for example, I didn't realize that my kids weren't bringing home art projects from school until I had bio kids. And then okay. they're bringing home all the papers and all the, you know, the about me at the beginning of the school year and their art projects and different things. And it never even occurred to me that my older kids never once brought that stuff home.
Okay.
And so I took it as rejection because it's like, why can't you share with me? Like, you made this beautiful poster, you worked on this, you worked so hard, you got an A, you know, all these different things where I want to rejoice and celebrate them, but they mm-hmm. didn't want to share that with me. So I took it as rejection. I took it as they don't trust me. They don't want me to participate in that part of their lives. And I still get that. I mean, they're grown young adults and they still, you know, they don't tell me certain things and it's not anything important really,
right.
but it's just not, you know, it's protected. They're protective of what they share. Mm-hmm. And I take it personally.
And it sounds like that is what I hear you say when you were giving advice to individuals who are considering being foster parents or adoptive parents is that the children may feel a sense of lack of trust,
yeah,
lack of bonding, right? Even a lack of rejection, even though it may not be something that's actually happening, but because of the circumstances. Yeah. But what I hear you saying as well, Liz, is that on your end, as the mother, you sort of felt the same thing.
Yeah. Totally. Right?
You felt rejection. You felt like they didn't trust you, you know? And so here's the question, where's the happy medium, right? Like, how do you get to that point to where everyone really begins to buy into to saying, we are truly a family, regardless of how we became a family. We are a family. I love you. You love me. I trust you. You trust me. How do we continue to grow? You know, I think that's the question that may sometimes go unanswered.
Exactly. And it really, I think it ebbs and flows because sometimes, you know, like, you know, I really struggled with one of my kids and I fought and I fought and I fought. And it was like so many times I wanted to give up with just professionals and the system and all sorts of things. And, you know, I would get down and then I would come back up and I would fight again. And so every now and again, you know, I will throw it back at his face. Like, nobody will fight harder than your mother for you. Nobody loves you as much as I do. And whether you feel that or not, you can look at all these examples of me fighting and getting labels on myself because I am enraged at treatment of this, this, and this. So I, you know, and it is funny because as they're older, you know, they start to realize, you know, well, maybe I should do this. I go, well, if I hear you correctly, what you're saying is, I told you so. Mother was right. Right? Like, so, you know, things do sink in. And I feel like, you know, anytime I have the opportunity to throw it back in their face that I was right, and they could have just listened to me all along. You know, that goes back to the trust part, right? Like, you didn't really trust me that I was telling you the truth. And I had to sit back and watch you learn it. But I'm also going to let you know that I was right. So you're welcome.
All right. So let's dive into one conversation as well. So when we talk about biological and not, the twins are biologically related.
Yes.
What is their relationship like if you were to compare their relationship to everyone else in your home?
Yeah. So there was a period of time when they did not speak at all. My son was out of the house. My daughter was, so he had more outward behaviors and hers was more, she would turn hers more inward. So there's the term glass children, you know, she would just sort of like, I don't want to cause any more trouble because I know they're already dealing with this. So I'll keep it to myself. So there was a little bit of that. And then once we could really see what she was going through, it was, oh, he's to blame for everything. And so I'm not going to talk to him. And then, you know, that's, of course, that's not really, that's how she interpreted it, right? Like, I need to blame somebody, and seems to be the easiest reason not to talk to him. So now that they're older, they are much closer. I don't even know if I would say closer. They talk. For a while, they didn't even exchange phone numbers. Like, they wouldn't even talk to each other. They didn't even have each other's cell phone numbers.
Oh, wow.
But they do have this, you know, they did this twin talk thing where they're, you know, they're communicating somehow or another, and I'll talk to one and I'll say something. And then the other one will say, well, I know exactly what they're thinking. They're doing this, this, and this. I'm like, oh, okay. But then at the same time, they try to say, well, I don't know. Why do you think? It's just because we're twins, we know. But I know intimately that they can feel each other, you know, what's going on, and they can figure out how the other one is processing.
Okay.
So, you know, one says this to me once, you know, they tell the other twin something different. And then we all compare notes and like, why would this story take a spin this way? Well, because they think it's this, this, and this, and they think you're going to do that. So they, you know, they have a very unique connection, that I don't see in my other kids that are siblings.
Okay. So Liz, maybe a very touchy question I'm about to ask you.
Yeah.
Would you do it all over again?
I would for my kids. Now, if someone came to me today and said, you know, there's children and they, you know, they're in a situation and can you take them? I don't know that I would start all over. I've learned a lot about myself through the whole journey, and how resilient that I've become. And just when I think I can't handle anymore, something else happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I, you know, I thought I was prepared. I read all the books. I did everything. And nothing, nothing prepares you.
So what I heard you say, strong word, I've been resilient.
Yeah.
Right. So when we think of grief, right, it's finding the inner strength to navigate through a world that seems so uncommon, a world that seems so lonely, but to be able to come out or come through the situation and have some sense of resilience to be able to come through the situation and be able to say, you know what? Some days were tough, was tough as hell.
Yeah.
But here I am, right? Here I am able to tell my story, even throughout all the challenges that I face, even though I know there still could be some more challenges that I may face. I've been resilient enough to know that I am not the only one that have went through this and won't be the only one who will continue to go through this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say that's, you know, I have this whitish gray hair. It's like, this does not come from a relaxing lifestyle, right? Like this is from being stressed out so much. And then, you know, realizing that I've gone through all this just from my perspective, right? I mean, they've gone through their stuff. I've gone through my stuff. I'm continuing to go through my stuff, but really feeling like I need to share this with other people because it is so isolating and you feel so alone and you feel like the world's against you. And it's a horrible feeling to have. And if you can just tell one person that, oh no, it sucks. And it, some days it's all consuming and other days it's not. So you just try to get through those days that are not all consuming and, you know, and when they are all, when you get sucked into the grief of all of it, that you're able to bounce out of it quicker than you did before.
Yes. So what is some, what is some advice that you would give someone that is in Liz's shoes on how to navigate where they are today?
Yeah. So I think what has really helped me, and at least initially and over the years really, is I was so focused on the immediate crises that were happening, right? Like we have to figure this out. Like I got to the point where I couldn't go into the basement to wash clothes because I was afraid of leaving my kids together. And so like they would have to come with me, or I'd bring them into the bathroom with me so that the other ones couldn't cause any issues. And so once I had some space away from that sort of immediate crisis and trying to avoid all the chaos, I was able to have all this like time, whether it was real or imagined, but I had more free time in my head to think of what I can do. And for me, if I sit too long and think about what's happening, then I just start to spiral and stew in my own thoughts. And so I needed a distraction. So for someone in the same spot that I was in, I would say find a distraction that is healthy. For me, it was like crafting and painting and doing those things, which is what I loved to do when I was a kid. So, you know, I think if you could find something that you enjoyed when you were a child that you really haven't had the chance to do, it is, if it's solitary and you appreciate that, or that's all you can do, then great. Because then, you know, like I would paint furniture and I would sand things and I would get my frustration out with sanding off a finish or something. And nobody wants to help me. Nobody wants to be around. So it was like, okay, good. And all I have to do is this. Sandpaper doesn't talk back. Paint doesn't talk back, you know, and it was really cathartic for me to be able to find something that I could change and manipulate and see from start to finish that I could change something, that I had control over something. And at the same time, really take joy from it and really enjoy being creative and doing something that was really only for me.
So it was about finding that me time.
Yeah.
Right. That also translated into just self-care.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just being able to decompress all the things around you that I heard you say that you may have not been able to control.
Yes. And allow myself really to steal, not even just find the time, really to steal the time, because, you know, as a parent, as a mother, as a wife, as a partner, your time typically is not your own. Like you know, you're lucky to get a little bit of time for yourself and what's left over, but really saying like, you know what? No, like the kids are occupied. I don't have to run anywhere. Or even, you know, while they're at practice for whatever, I can read a book, I can listen to a podcast, I can do something that I want to do, even if it's, you know, the crossword puzzle, just doing something, forcing yourself to do something that isn't related to your life outside of you. It's just for you.
Was there ever a time during those moments that you ever felt guilty by taking Liz's self-care time, me time, away from everybody else?
Yes. Yes. Many times, which, again, I don't think is uncommon for females in general, but really for caretakers, because you feel like I have this extra time. I should be spending it with them. I should be creating something with them. I should be, you know, whatever it is. If they're, you know, if they like cookies, you should be making them cookies or going shopping together, finding out their, you know, playing their favorite game. So yeah, there was a lot of that. But what I found was that I felt more refreshed. And so okay. It was sort of like reset my battery a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so that replaced the guilt, because the guilt doesn't serve you very well in that scenario. And so I really just needed to find something where I could refresh, and then I could go like, okay, you're not as annoying as you were before. So I'm, and it really helps everybody.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So Liz, as we are getting closer to the end of the segment, the question I always ask my guests is provide one heart-to-heart message about grief, healing, or unforeseen circumstances when it comes to being an adoptive parent.
So one piece of advice?
Yes.
Yeah. My number one piece of advice, which would apply to any of those categories, is to trust your gut. To trust your gut if you feel like something isn't right with how your children are reacting, behaving, how your partner isn't understanding what's happening, or how you feel about it. So if your gut is telling you that you've tried everything, you need to believe yourself. You need to not constantly doubt what you're telling yourself. If you make a decision, you need to be comfortable with that decision and just trust yourself.
Well, Liz, again, I want to thank you today for being a guest on Heart to Heart with Keisha B. I can definitely say the information that you have shared with myself, as well as our listeners today, will allow them to know that behind their smiles, even though it may be a challenge of being an adoptive parent, that they too can be as beneficial and impactful in the life of a young person. So again, thank you.
Thank you, Keisha. This was a great time. Thanks so much.
Thank you for tuning in to Heart with Keisha B. Remember, grief may shape our journey, but it doesn't define who we are. Healing is not a straight path, but with every step forward, you're creating space for hope, strength, and new beginnings. If today's episode brought you comfort or clarity, share it with someone who might need it too. Let's continue building this community of compassion and resilience together. Until next time, take care of your heart, your mind, and your soul. Honor your journey and always know that brighter days are ahead. I am Keisha B, and this has been Heart to Heart.